That's our theme music from Sarita Murdoch's Many Lines on Mental Health Radio. Take It From Us. I'm Sheldon Brown, and Take It From Us is brought to you by Framework. Now, today we talk about a book, or more accurately, a memoir by Mrs. D, who's now come out under her real name of Lotta Dan. Lotta's been on Take It From Us talking about getting sober and how drinking impacted her mental health. Lotta wrote her first memoir called Mrs. D Is Going Without, which told her story about quitting her dysfunctional drinking habits. The memoir we talked to Lotta about today is called Mrs. D Is Going Within. Lotta discovered that her lifelong heavy drinking had left her as a fledgling emotionally, with bouts of niggling anxiety and unease. So here's Lotta to tell us what going within really means. Welcome, Lotta, back to Take It From Us.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, and we're talking to you in Wellington. How's it down there today?
Cold and wet, Sheldon. What do you expect?
Well, we've got warm and wet up here, so that's the only difference. It's a little clammy, actually, in Auckland. The temperature is sort of around 16, 17, I think, but it's as wet as a shag.
That sounds positively balmy to me.
So I just wonder, what sort of symptoms of dis-ease or anxiety were you experiencing? Well, I suppose it's you've written this book. It's probably nearly 12 months ago that these symptoms started to arrive, or even earlier, perhaps.
Yeah, I probably started noticing about 2 or 3 years after I quit drinking. You know, initially when I took alcohol out of my life, that was so much of a focus for me, and just learning how to not drink, it really dominated my experience. And after about 2 or 3 years of being sober, when sober became ordinary, which is a wonderful thing, right? I wasn't fighting to not drink every day. I just didn't drink, and that was my norm. That was great. But then what I started noticing was this other stuff that was going on for me. And, you know, when you're sober all the time and raw, there's really no escaping how you're feeling. And I just wasn't feeling great. And I feel almost bad admitting that, because I always want to promote being sober, because it is amazing and I love it and it's so much better than being boozy. But the truth is, you know, when you take alcohol away, you really discover what's underneath. And for me, yeah, there was definitely, I'd call it a low-grade anxiety. I'd often find myself almost with a nervous tummy, like something was wrong, and I'd be thinking, you know, why am I nervous? Have I got something to do later today, or have I just received an email I'm worried about? And I'd sort of try and figure out, and there wasn't anything specific. I just felt edgy, and I started realizing I needed to do something about that.
Did you feel that your mental health was, threatened or impacted?
Yeah, well, yes, because I felt, you know, uncomfortable. I wasn't just cruising through my days. I was fraught, and I had this, you know, physical sensation of nerves and butterflies in my tummy, tightening in my chest. I mean, all of that is your mental health, isn't it? I mean, I don't want to over-exaggerate it, because in general I don't suffer from any major anxiety or depression or anything like that. I mean, I don't. But I have a low-grade sense often of being just wound up, you know, and I was just, like I say, I became very aware of that because I was sober, number one, and number two, I wasn't putting so much energy into not drinking. So I just found I got to a point where it was like, I need to do some further work on myself, you know.
Do you think that this, I mean, we described in the introduction that you sort of may have discovered that you were emotionally a fledgling, if you like, that was the impact of the alcohol, and you had to grow up emotionally. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and, you know, what was also happening as I spent more time being sober is that things were happening in my life that were hard. You know, I had my my beloved stepfather died. That was terrible grief. Stresses through work, you know, just stuff happening around me. And as those things occurred, especially the big things, I just really realised I was very ill-equipped to deal with them. I had no strategies of, you know, my go-to strategy had always been to have a drink. I mean, that's what I did. I always had a wine, and that is a strategy. It's not a particularly healthy one, but it worked for me for 20-plus years until I stopped drinking. And so, yeah, I just found I was ill-equipped emotionally to manage myself through these difficult things. And that's why I got to this point where I was like, I need to do some more work. I'm struggling here. I'm floundering around. I'm sober, and that's great. But now I need to do some more work.
Yeah, I mean, I've read the book, Mrs. D is Going Within, and there's occasions when I read pages where I almost thought that you were tempted to go back to the drink.
No, I don't think I've ever been properly tempted to go back to drink. I really don't, to be honest with you. I think I love having alcohol out of my life. I look at alcohol now as this stupid, you know, substance. I understand why so many of us drink, because it does work, but it's so destructive and dysfunctional, really, as a coping mechanism, and I feel quite detached from it. I'm happy to have it out of my life. I don't want to go back to where I was at all. But I did have other coping mechanisms that were unhealthy, particularly food, sugar, and flour. I can be very alcoholic in my relation to those foods.
Oh,
yeah,
flour.
And I've just been reading a book, a really interesting book about the brain, which sets out, you know, very clearly the science behind the fact that flour and sugar impact on the brain in the same way as alcohol and cocaine, because they've been so refined down from their original
product
date.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I can crave ciabatta rolls and have three in a sitting.
Right.
I mean, we're not talking about healthy food. We're talking about, you know, quite alcoholic behaviours.
Right.
And this was the other thing I was noticing, along with my discomfort and butterflies and tightening in my chest and, you know, feeling a bit anxious, was also that I was really reaching for and acting in the same way as I was when I was drinking with these foods, and having the same guilt and the same cravings, and I just was really stuck and needed to.
Did you classify those as addictions, do you think, or?
I'm still working on it now. And when I wrote this last book, I was binging on sugary, floury foods throughout. I have to be honest.
To get what? To get you through to meet the deadline of producing the memoir.
Exactly. I mean, how ironic is that? Here I was writing about how I'm working on my mental health, and I was still acting at the same time in a very unhealthy way. But I'm honest about that in the book. I mean, I'm always honest about it, because I never want to purport to be this perfect example of how to sort yourself out. But
I think you're exceedingly honest in this book, and that's one of the wonderful aspects of it. How about your self-esteem and self-image, I guess, while you were writing this memoir, Mrs. D is Going Within, but also, I guess, on your, well, I suppose you'd call it a path to self-discovery, to discovering strategies and wellness tools that were going to help this unease that you had.
Yeah, I mean, I exposed myself very greatly in the book, and that was uncomfortable for me to write and to put out. And I don't know why I'm driven to be so honest, but I am, and so there was this one part of me that was driven to kind of be brutally honest and write it out, and I was doing that, but at the same time, I was feeling very exposed and raw and vulnerable about that, and coping with those feelings by having unhealthy behaviours, self-sabotaging behaviours.
Right, but isn't honesty the only really effective approach to wellness?
Yeah, I do believe so. Absolutely. And even just talking honestly now you know, it always helps me, and I think people obviously relate to that. But there is a, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say I pay a price, because I can be left feeling very vulnerable, and when I feel that kind of strong emotion, I self-sabotage. This is what I still need to work on, is not moving to behaviours that are self-sabotaging when I'm feeling very uncomfortable in my own skin. I mean, and it sounds funny, because no one made me write this book, right? I mean, it was my choice.
Well, but, you'd written one with the title, Mrs. D is Going Without, and once you adopted some of these strategies that we're going to talk about, it was natural, surely, to write a follow-up, a second in the series, yes. Well, let's get on to some of those strategies that, you played around with a little bit, you know, didn't you? And then suddenly you started to realise the benefits. What were some of those strategies that you relate to in the heading of this book, or the title of the book, about going within yourself?
Well, I'd been hearing, you know, I spend a bit of time on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, and I kept hearing all these other wellness people talking about things like yoga and gratitude and mindfulness. And to be honest with you, I'd always been very resistant. I thought it was wishy-washy, claptrap, you know, monks on mountaintops, not for me. But I got to this point where I was feeling so uncomfortable. I knew I was having these other unhealthy behaviors around food. And so I just thought, right, I'm going to try these things. Bugger it, you know, let's just see. What are they? How do they work in practical terms? Because I'm always very practical. Like, I want, practically speaking, how's this going to impact on my days? I'm going to, you know, research them, basically. And so I set about. And as you know, if you've read the book, you know, there was a lot of trial and error. I would try different kind of meditation teachers like Deepak Chopra, or, you know, I'd go to a yoga class and I'd hate it. You know, there was a lot of no, and thankfully I didn't give up. And one of the things I really hope that people do get out of the book is, you know, the sense that if you try one or two things and they don't work, don't give up. There's so much available out there, you know, different classes you can go to, different people you can listen to online. Keep going until you find the ones that fit with you. And eventually I did, and you know, I did, after three goes, found the yoga class that worked for me, and now I've gone from hating yoga to absolutely loving it. I mean, last night I was really stressed and grumpy, and I went to my yoga class,
yeah.
And when I came out of it, I felt more relaxed and positive. I mean, it was that tangible in 1 hour from doing yoga. I don't know, I mean, why exactly, but it works.
Well, you know, and it's wonderful to get that reward from just an hour's effort, isn't it? I do what's called a Sunday Restore yoga session once a month, and that's actually 2.5 hours, and it's not about standing on your head or doing anything sort of athletic. It's very much about just relaxing into a pose, which normally is lying down and putting your thigh and your leg on a support, and then breathing, and I come out of there, well, I do come out absolutely zen-like.
I know.
And then I get back into Auckland's traffic, and by the time I get
home. Well, that's the thing. I mean, life keeps going on. And the other big thing that I researched is mindfulness, and just really starting, you know, it unlocks for me this real understanding of my brain and my thought patterns and how it works and how lost I get in my thinking. And just having the ability to identify what you're doing, and with something like yoga, it just forces you to break out of those patterns for a while, which can be so relaxing, because we spend a lot of time thinking, don't we?
Well, we do, and it's managing that thinking, and I think mindfulness is a brilliant tool, wellness tool, but you really, I think, would it be fair to say that you got a bit lucky with mindfulness? You went online and you were very impressed with a couple of practitioners.
Yeah, I mean, I tried Deepak Chopra and Oprah's website. That didn't work for me. And then I tried an app called Headspace, which is hugely popular, but it wasn't right for me. And then I stumbled upon a book, which someone, I think, recommended to me through my blog. And I got it out of the library. And then I, and it was an 8-week plan. And I, so quite early on, I stumbled onto this book and I followed their plan to the letter for 8 weeks. And that really unlocked it for me. Only by really forcing myself to do it for the 8 weeks every day, you know, as instructed, did I start actually understanding what the concepts were and what impact they could have, practically speaking, on my days.
Well, you, you had a few challenges, though, with three boys, is it, under 12, and a busy household, and having to get up and surreptitiously sort of lean against the sofa.
Well, that's right. But, you know, the main thing, I think, to realise with mindfulness is it's very subtle and it's very slow burning. And it, you know, and for someone like me who's an alcoholic, who's used to kind of quick, fast, you know, let's just fix this or let's just, you know, make it hard and fast, to have to kind of slow yourself and get into it and then slowly start to see the benefits, it's a real adjustment. But once, you know, I'd made that adjustment and I started seeing these little impacts, that I really start getting it. And, I mean, I'm still a huge work in progress, really, still got a long way to go, but the fact that I've got the concepts now and I can use it, and sometimes I need to use it more than others.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
You know, it works.
Yeah, well, let's come back and talk about that slow burn characteristic of mindfulness. We're playing a bit of Chicago on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and we've got a track which I think is relevant to mindfulness and wellness tools. You're the Inspiration.
And I want you here with me.
Well, that's Chicago on Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. You're the inspiration, and we're talking to Lotta Dan, who I think we can rightfully describe as an author and writer, but also a blogger and somebody that knows a lot about the gains of becoming sober and sobriety. That's a fair description, Lotta?
Yes. That is a fair description.
Right. Well, we were talking about the slow burn effect of mindfulness, and I guess in my practice of mindfulness, as I do it more regularly, then the benefits become, I guess, more clear-cut.
Yeah, and I think the word regularly is the key here and the word practice, because it's not something you read a book and then you get it and then you have it. It is something you need to practice daily if you can, because then you can start changing the patterns of your mind. And it's, you know, I think I've said this to you before, but it's quite hard to articulate. You can describe what it is and you can hear someone describe it, but until you start actually doing it yourself, and seeing the little subtle difference it can make to your whole experience of life, then you can really appreciate. I mean, if anyone's listening who hasn't tried it, I heartily recommend you give it a go for a week, say, where you find a book or a podcast and you just try and practice it, and you'll slowly start to see that you have this ability to recognize what you're thinking about and just disengage from the thoughts, even just for a second. Thank you, brain, for worrying about that email. Now, if you don't mind, I'm just going to feel the water on my hands as I wash these dishes. I mean, it sounds like nothing, but if you just do that occasionally, you start to disengage and not get so caught up in thinking, which can lead us to all manner of, you know, disease.
Well, put simply, I mean, with that example where you just focus on the water on your hands as you do the dishes, I mean, you're living in the present, aren't you? You're focusing on the thing that you are doing, and mindfulness is often, you know, recommends that that's how we live our life.
Yeah, and because, you know, difficult things happen, right? Emails are sent that are concerning and worrying. So you get the email, it's concerning and worrying, you have to deal with it. Now, you feel some disease when you get the email, right? And then, but if you spend the next 3 or 4 hours worrying and fretting and thinking about that email, then it's really bled into your day hugely, right? And then you have to reply to the email. So you can choose whether or not to spend those 3 or 4 hours in between receiving and then replying to the email. You can choose whether or not you spend all of that time being very sort of tightly wound thinking about it, or whether you can try and have snatches of time within that where you don't. And if you can do the latter and break out of the worry, it creates a more calm experience, and it makes you in a better state to actually deal with it when you need to. Does that make sense? I'm sorry, I feel like that was a bit convoluted.
Well, it certainly makes sense to me, but you have admitted that there's a sort of fairly significant development which is stressing you out right at the moment. I mean, without necessarily going into the detail of that, how is your mindfulness helping you through this?
Yeah, so right now I'm in the middle of what I would describe as quite a difficult situation for me, and it's an emotional situation. It's not something I have a lot of control over. I'm trying to manage my way through it as best I can, but it's stressing me out. It is, and I'm aware of the fact that I am thinking about it a lot. I'm creating imaginary conversations in my mind with people that don't even... they're not even aware they're fighting with me in my mind. I'm creating the fight.
Right.
And
God, they're a bloody nuisance, those imaginary conversations, aren't they?
Yeah. So this is a really difficult situation for me. It's quite extreme. And now that I'm aware of, you know, I've got mindfulness as a tool, I'm aware of how it works, I'm very aware of how my mind works, I can see, it's almost like I've got a little observer standing back who can see me being fixated on this. And that little observer in my mind is just pulling me up constantly. You know, you stop thinking about this now. You're having a shower. Think about the shower. Stop you know, worrying about this now. You're cooking dinner. Think about the mince. I mean, again, it sounds like nothing much, but I think it is helping me, definitely, this mindfulness, because I'm just able to have moments where I'm relaxing myself. And because I've been practicing for a while now, every time I think to myself, like, for example, in the shower this morning, there I was, locked in another imaginary fight or discussion with someone. I recognized what I was doing. I literally made myself stop, focus on the soap, which is a nice new soap I bought from a fancy store. And it worked for a moment there. I could feel myself just relax and go, oh, look, I'm in a lovely hot shower with a nice soap.
Yeah, well,
just a little moment like that can have an overall impact on me.
I used to, those imaginary conversations would happen when I woke up in the middle of the night, and if I was frustrated by somebody, perhaps at work, I'd, you know, almost draft a letter in my head. I've adopted a little saying now that just says, focus on the now and relax. And I say that to myself in bed, breathe in, focus on the now, and breathe out, just saying relax. And inevitably, I will go back to sleep. And, you know, I wake up 7 o'clock in the morning and I think to myself, boy, that strategy, that little tactic really works well.
Isn't that lovely? Because after a while of practicing like this, that part of your brain that's fretting and worrying does lose some of its power, because you're just seeing it for what it is, and it's disempowering it slightly. And
it's
really important.
It is about living in the now, I think. And I've been to mindfulness workshops, and people have said, well, when do you do your planning? And, you know, that's a dilemma that I had faced. And people say to me, well, if you live in the now, you know, you've got to be able to plan. Anyway, this mindfulness facilitator said, well, he allocates between 5:30 and 6:30 each day to do his planning. And I thought, well, that's a pretty sensible way of going about it.
Yeah, that sounds very good. If you can compartmentalise like that, fantastic.
Yeah. So you know, you did say that you were a bit stressed about this issue. You've got a lack of control. How do you think, you know, what tactics or strategies will you adopt to counter this stress?
I've got a few, really, that I'm applying. I mean, I'm really trying to work really hard on managing this one. One of the big sort of concepts of mindfulness is acceptance and not wasting energy wishing things were different than what they actually are. So I'm really just working on trying to accept this is the situation. Now how do I manage it rather than I wish it wasn't like this? That's just a waste of energy. So acceptance. I am, you know, it sounds cliche, but I'm also really trying to look for the positives in it, because there are positives in it. So that's a kind of a gratitude attitude, I suppose, but just trying to make sure that I keep reminding myself these are the positive things about what's happening, because that they are there, right? It's not all negative. Yeah, and also just telling myself, you know, the only constant is change. Nothing ever stays the same, ever. So, you know, this, in a sense, this is inevitable. Everything changes all the time. So all of those things to try and help myself roll with it rather than harden and tighten and fight it.
But, I mean, you've made a lot of changes, haven't you? I mean, there is a saying, if we always do what we've always done, we'll always get what we always got. And, you know, I think...
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I use it at my wellness classes that I facilitate. And I think it really underlines a critical message. So you've made a lot of changes, and it sounds as though, you know, you're on the road to, well, a self-discovery and practicing things a little bit differently.
Yeah, and also trying to forgive myself when I make mistakes, because I still do make mistakes and I get things wrong and my interpretation isn't you know, necessarily the accurate view. And I'm so forgiveness as well, forgiving myself as well, and just accepting myself with my flaws is another big one. I mean, you know, it's hard being a human. It really is. We're all trying to do the best we can.
But, I mean, this approach of more mindfulness and your yoga practice, isn't this about being kinder to ourselves? I mean, being grateful as well?
Yes, absolutely it is. And just, yeah, and just looking for the good, positive things and having an understanding of what we need, you know, to balance our lives out. Because one of the other tools that I write about in my book is our dog, and he's literally just walked into the room and I'm patting him as we speak.
Oh, lovely.
But getting a dog and taking him for walks every day, you know, that's also had a really positive impact on my mental health. So just trying to fill your life up with the things that are going to counterbalance the tricky things.
Well, let's come back and talk about counterbalancing the tricky things. We're playing Chicago on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and this track is called A Hard Habit to Break, and Lotta, you've probably had a few hard habits to break.
Until it's gone, and I found out.
that's a hard habit to break. And we're talking to Lotta Dan. I've got her book in front of me, and it says on the front cover, "How a frantic, sugar binging, internet loving, recovering alcoholic housewife found her zen." So I hope I wasn't too unkind, Lotta, in saying that that you may have had some hard habits to break.
No, not at all. That is the truth.
Right. Well, we were talking about the benefits of kindness. I mean, have you also felt yourself being sort of calmer, maybe more composed?
Yeah, definitely. Overall, I'm much calmer and more composed, without a doubt. I mean, not just from when I was boozing, but even since I got sober, since I embarked on this project to fill up my toolbox with things that were going to, you know, help me deal with emotional stuff, and implemented these strategies, I have, vastly improved and calmed down, and just got more appreciative and just calmer and better.
Have friends or people close to you, or you've got a big family that, you know, you go to family events and describe those in your book, Mrs. D is Going Within. Have people remarked about, you know, perhaps your composure?
No. They haven't. I don't know what they would... I mean, I hope they would notice. I mean, a lot of the stuff is quite deep inside, so it would be interesting to know how much of it shows on the outside. I'm sure my kids are pretty oblivious, really. I mean, you know, I hope they notice that Mum's calmer and less angry and more present. I'm certain my husband would tell you that he's noticed that I'm, you know, better overall.
Right.
But, yeah, no one else has really commented. I think they're all just busy with their own lives.
But I think you describe in the book, Mrs. D is Going Within, that one of your opportunities to do a bit of mindfulness is to arrive at school a little bit earlier when picking up your boys and do a bit of mindfulness while you're sitting in the car. And didn't a friend come up to you? Didn't you describe a friend coming up and remarking about this?
She did. I was sitting there, you know, listening to one of my audios that went with the book. I did my 8-week plan. They've got these free audios online, and you listen to the professor of mindfulness, you know, guiding you through a wee meditation. And I was doing it in the car with my eyes shut one day.
Yeah, right.
And feeling like a bit conspicuous. And sure enough, I got spotted by a friend who remarked to me at the school gate, "Oh, you're having a little moment there, Lotta."
Right. Did you let on that you were doing this very valuable practice of mindfulness and relaxation?
I did. And she, you know, funnily enough, she's one of the people, in fact, quite a lot of people talk to me about this stuff now, but it's now that the book's come out. But prior to that, she was one of the few people that I had discussions with about this sort of thing, and she was in tune with it herself. So her attitude was quite a sort of affectionate one. Mm. She recognised, I think, what I was doing.
Do you get an opposite reaction from some people when you mention mindfulness?
You know, I don't mention it a lot unless they bring it up, because I know that there are people who have no kind of understanding or interest in it. And, you know, I'm already, I don't want to say different, but I've already sort of put myself out there as being sober. And I try and not, in my normal circle of life around my community, I try and not also go on a lot about what I'm doing in this area with mindfulness and what have you, unless they bring it up, because I just don't know, you know, they have to be sort of interested in it themselves, I suppose.
Yeah, well, we did a piece with a psychologist on Take It From Us just a couple of weeks ago. There was some research done by a hotel chain that were trying to support the idea of Kiwis going on short breaks. And this research suggested that at least 65% of Kiwis are stressed, either moderately stressed or highly stressed. And the work and family issues are the major things. Oh, sorry, work, money and family issues are the major things that Kiwis are stressed about. Well, if, you know, two-thirds of Kiwis are stressed, then telling them about mindfulness might be a fairly helpful tactic for them.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I suppose that's part of the reason why I did write the book, is because I did find it amazingly helpful for me. So why not share what I learned in the hopes that it might connect with some people? But I think, you know, in my day-to-day, like I say, when I move around my community, interacting with other mums and dads, you know, you have to be careful what you want to be blurting out, because you don't want to, you know, people have to want to be interested in going there themselves. But isn't it remarkable how people can mask what's really going on inside? I mean, you know, I believe that statistic about how many people are stressed and anxious, but you can't tell that from walking around and being at the supermarket or on the sidelines of rugby. You can't, you know, people, what's going on inside, unless someone's very honest and exposing about that, you really don't know.
Well, at a rugby game somewhere in New Zealand the other day, somebody ripped the corner flag out and took to a supporter because she was supporting the wrong side, supporting the opposition.
Right.
So
right.
Maybe
so
that's
occasionally it might burst out in a behaviour like that, you know. But most of the time, we're all sort of putting on a mask. Well, not a mask, but, you know, just interacting at a level where you wouldn't really know unless someone chose to let you in what's going on inside.
Well, isn't that fairly typical of New Zealand? I mean, most of us are masking our emotions with alcohol, aren't we?
Well, yeah, there is that. There is that.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to say there's a lovely feature in your memoir, which is called Mrs. D is Going Within, where you list strategies which you are beginning to help, even though some of them fall by the wayside. But you've got this little chart which appears regularly through the book. I think that's a really lovely feature.
Yeah, my toolbox. I actually had that idea while I was walking the dog. Just goes to show how good walking the dog is for your creativity. No, I just had this idea to illustrate my toolbox, you know, in a literal box in the book, so that I could show, you know, I have a lack of tools. I'm working on building up tools, and be very clear about what was in my toolbox, what I put in, took out because it didn't work, what's ended up in. And even now, since the book's gone out, my toolbox changed a bit. I mean, it's an ever-changing thing, but I think it's quite helpful to think clearly about what do I have in place to help me through my day? Mm. What are the things that I have that I can draw from when I need to? Ooh. And they can be silly little things like patting the cat or practicing gratitude or doing yoga or whatever, but good, nourishing, proper, you know, wholesome sort of things that aren't about self-sabotaging or avoiding, that are really proper things that can help you properly deal with stuff.
Yeah, well, the Mental Health Foundation, you know, has a strategy of encouraging us to flourish by doing things, by offering support and by mixing with people and being open and other things. So you use the word nourishing, they use the word flourishing. I think they're very much the same. But, you know, by the end of the book, Mrs. D is Going Within, you've sort of determined what wellness tools are going to be valuable to Lotta Dan. What are they?
Well, by the end of the book, I have in place, you know, my community, my sober community online, and the concept of sober treats, which is by, you know, just little things like fresh flowers and candles that can send you a little message that you're looking after yourself. And then I have the proper sort of more grounding tools that I worked on, which are mindfulness, regular exercise, walking the dog, yoga, gratitude, which I actually developed as a practice with my kids. I found that's what worked for me, doing it with my kids at bedtime. And then other things which are aspects of mindfulness, like acceptance and compassion. And, you know, it's funny now, I had a busy week last week. I had to give a talk in Parliament, and I was nervous about that. And I didn't get to the gym, I didn't get to yoga, and it was raining, and I didn't walk the dog. And I knew when I woke up on Monday morning, I need to put those things back in my week this week. So I'm very clear now in my toolbox, and if I drop these practices, I need to pick them up again, because they really work overall to make me feel calmer and better.
So it's the repetitive, it's really the practice, isn't it? I mean, I think, like if I want to play tennis, well, I can't just go out on the court and expect to perform, particularly at my age, if I haven't really played for 3 weeks and I've done nothing else except being a couch potato. You know, so isn't our wellness and our mental health, well, we have to practice these things.
Yeah, and be realistic about what you're putting in. If you're putting in, I'm going to go to the gym, and then that's too hard for your lifestyle, don't fret. Take it out and put something else in. I'm going to stretch every night before bed for 10 minutes, you know? Just something that is a tool which is achievable for you that does keep you on that wellness path and makes you feel better about yourself. Because if you are managing those things, doing them, like the actual stretching, is obviously nice for your body and your mind, but knowing that you've done it is helpful for your self-esteem and your general feelings of self-worth. I'm looking after myself. I'm doing okay this week. I'm doing my stretching, you know?
Yeah, and being grateful about it, being grateful that we can actually do those things.
Yeah, gratitude is an interesting one, because it seems like nothing at all and it seems super cheesy, but it actually is very powerful.
Some people have a big bottle on the sideboard with things that they, you know, they're grateful for, and they write them down on a little post-it note and put it in that bottle and then pull them out every so often.
Yeah, I tried that as well. I had a gratitude bowl or a happiness bowl. Some people do it in bed before they get up. I found what worked for me was doing it at night with my kids. So we... when I tuck them in, we think of 3 things that were good for the day or that we're grateful for. And we repeat a lot of things too, but I think it really has a cumulative effect where you're just not just focusing on what's stressing you out or busy or worrisome, but actually, oh, these things are actually ticking along nicely and they're very, you know, they're good and they're making me feel good. And just remembering to put our attention on those as well.
In terms of mindfulness, have you got any websites that you would recommend or particular practitioners? I mean, I have a CD from I think he's one of the mindfulness gurus, and I think you mentioned him in the book, John Kabat-Zinn.
Yeah, he's one of the leading lights. He's amazing. The book that really cracked it for me that I mentioned earlier was called Mindfulness, Finding Peace in a Frantic World, and it's written by Professor Mark Williams and a man called Danny Penman. And Mark Williams is incredible, and he's got audios and talks you can listen to online. I also really like Tara Brach. I listen to her hour-long talks, and also she has guided meditations on her website that you can, you know, lie down and listen to for 20 minutes or so. And I love Sharon Salzberg. She's a New York... She worked with John Kabat-Zinn, I think. She's got a Facebook page. I mean, a lot of these people put out free stuff on their website. They sell books and what have you as well, but they also provide a lot for free.
Oh, that's wonderful. Where can people obtain your book, Mrs. D Is Going Within?
It's still in bookstores. I checked the airport yesterday and there it was. So it's still in hard copy around the country, and it's available on Mighty Ape and Fish Pond and Book Depository.
Sales gone well?
Honestly, I don't know.
Really?
I haven't heard. I think it's fine. It hasn't been as much as the first book, because it didn't have the big dramatic kind of outing of myself as an alcoholic. I got a lot of media with the first book because of that announcement. But I think it's ticking along okay. Yeah.
And you've done other media interviews about the book?
Yes, I did. I did a few radio and a bit of press. Yeah, this will be my last memoir. I'm not writing about myself again. I'm happy to have done it, but it was very exposing, and I did feel vulnerable when I first put it out. So I think I'm going to draw a line under that now.
Okay, but you didn't get any repercussions as a result of being so open?
No, I've had nothing but lovely feedback. No, it was more just a personal, you know, the impact it had on me. I really struggled with a little bit, but I don't regret it, but I'm just honest that it wasn't the most easy thing to go through, but I'm okay about that now. I think I'm over that now.
Yeah, well, I'm a great believer in frankness and honesty when it comes to wellness. I think that's the only way to operate.
Yeah, I think I agree with you.
Well, Lotta, thank you very much for coming on Take It From Us again. It's a real delight to talk to you, and I would put in a personal endorsement for this book, Mrs. D Is Going Within. I think it's a very frank and honest, open sort of outline of getting hold of some really valuable wellness tools. But I think Lotta makes it clear that this is not a straightforward journey. It's got a few bumps and barriers in it.
Absolutely.
Okay, Lotta. Thank you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure. Before we finish up, let's take another track from Chicago called Look Away.
When you called me up this morning, told me about the new love you found, I said I'm happy for you, I'm really happy for you. Found someone else, I guess I won't be coming round, I guess it's over, baby, it's really over, baby. Whoa. And from what you said, I know you've gotten over me. It'll never be the way it used to be. So if it's gotta be this way, don't worry, baby, I can take the news, okay? But if you see me walking by, and the tears are in my eyes, said, I'm happy for you. I'm really happy for you.
So that's a look away from Chicago on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. We have been promoting Paul Emery's. Paul is a lifestyle coach at one of the mental health organisations. He's adopting an adventure by climbing Mount Kilimanjaro as a fundraiser for the Mental Health Foundation. He's one of a team of 26 that have almost reached the mark of $100,000, and they're very $100,000 to assist the Mental Health Foundation. Paul Emery came into this somewhat later than some of the other participants in this adventure to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, and I last heard that his fundraising is over $3,000. He's on target to get to $4,000. If you want to support Paul just in a small way, you can text Paul to 2446, which will donate a small amount of $3 directly to the Mental Health Foundation, and he suggests that that's the simplest and easiest way to go about it. But you can go on to the Mental Health Foundation's website at mentalhealth.org.nz, and you'll find the fundraising efforts there for the Kilimanjaro adventure, and you could donate more money to Paul. He has been running a number of fundraising efforts, and he recently completed a walk from Hamilton to South Auckland, travelling just over 100 kilometres, almost non-stop, over 26 hours. So Paul Emery is really putting his heart and soul into this fundraising effort for the Mental Health Foundation, and also to develop his own fitness to get up Africa's highest mountain. Well, that's taken from us, Mental Health Radio. I'm Sheldon Brown. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll be back again next Tuesday.